and I just find something and I launch from it. And that is kind of the foundation behind freefoiling. But I mean, also, you asked me the question earlier about my background. I guess you have to understand my background a little bit. I want to do the thing that inspires me the most. I've got kind of 10 years of human-powered aircraft building in my rearview mirror in a human-powered helicopter. High-speed aerodynamic bicycle.
This episode is sponsored by Foil Sessions, the foiling app that lets you track all your foiling sports. This is Up on Foil, the podcast for everyone flying just above the surface.
Pump, carve, soar, let's foil!
Welcome to episode number 61 of Up on Foil, the podcast where we talk all about foiling. And today's with Todd Reichert. And I was just thinking how I would introduce you, because myself, I'm an average foiler, but I love being on foil. But with you, it is different because you are a very important man in foiling. You're out of Canada. You're one of the two people who invented beta foil. And there's so much more about you, and we're going to go all into that. And I just asked before, like, where are you? What's that studio?
Yeah. The studio here that I'm in is a trailer. My kiddos just got home from school, so there's going to be a wrestling match going on inside. So I thought I'd just move out here. But I thought it was appropriate because this is actually where part of the idea, where it really crystallized, where it was like, this is what I'm going to do next with my life. I've been wanting to do some sort of human-powered watercraft hydrofoil thing for quite a while. But in 2018, my son was born. We took a year off work, and my wife and I totally gutted this thing and renovated it. This is a 1972 Airstream trailer. We stripped it down to the shell, redid from the ground up, like wiring, electrical, plumbing, everything. My wife's got an awesome design sense. So a lot of what you see now, this like beautiful interior, super cool space. Yeah, really, really nice space. And we moved into this trailer with our newborn son. We took a year off work and just kind of traveled around visiting my family, which is kind of spread across Canada, which is a reasonably large country. And so we sort of meandered across from one side to the other visiting. And I was just getting into mountain biking at the time as well. And everywhere we stopped, there wasn't necessarily like a good place to mountain bike, but we were always on like some beautiful lake. Like Canada is just endless, endless beautiful lakes everywhere you stop. And I'm just like, I want to go, you know, the equivalent of mountain biking on this lake right now. I have no idea how. And so that was kind of that's when it crystallized in my mind, was like, this is what I've got to do next. I've got kind of 10 years of human-powered aircraft building in my rearview mirror. And this is like a good lead into the next thing. So that's kind of where it started.
Very nice. Very, very interesting. We're getting just like, continue with that human-powered vehicles and that thing, sorry to call it that you built. That was part of your PhD, right?
Yes. Yeah. So and I shared some videos if you want to pop them up for people that are watching. It's kind of hard to, I'll try definitely to describe it in words, but like you just have to see it. These human-powered aircraft are, you know, the span of a football field. They weigh 100 pounds and they just like lifted the air as if they're floating. So my PhD was in the aerodynamics and kinematics of bird flight and how to replicate that in like a mechanical flapping wing aircraft. Coolest lab on the planet. Like honestly, just awesome. My professor is like the guy in the world on ornithopters. And I realized during that like for the first time in history, the foundation that my professor had laid in combination with what had already happened in human-powered aircraft in like the 70s and 80s, all the pieces there were together to effectively take on humanity's earliest dream of flight. Like, you know, Da Vinci, you know, you see in the sketchbooks, this is like humans looking up at the sky, seeing a bird and being like, I want to do that. I want to flap my arms and like fly through the sky, right? And like, since then we've landed on the moon and we still haven't flown like a bird. So it was like, okay, this is, you know, it's just a moment in time and we know how to do this and let's take this on. So that was part of my PhD. We built this human powered aircraft that flapped its wings driven by like a leg press motion. So like you push on this thing, it pulls the wings down, they bend and they make a flapping motion. And in In 2010, we succeeded at being the first team in the world to successfully maintain altitude and airspeed with such an aircraft. So that was like kind of the beginnings of this human power. Like, I was so lucky to have found a real passion at that age that combined like my excitement for athletic stuff, my excitement for doing things that are just kind of like out of the box, efficiency, and the aerodynamics. You know, I got into aerospace because it's just such a cool field, but the idea of building like a 737 wasn't nearly as exciting to me as building something that you can fly yourself. So yeah, that was the beginning. And then we took on another project. There was this 25-year aviation prize called the Sikorsky Prize. They set it up. It had gone unchallenged. Like, no one had won this prize in 25 years. Basically, they put out the challenge. Can you fly to 1 meter or fly up to 10 meters and stay up for 60 seconds in a human-powered helicopter? So this thing is like, it's a bicycle at the center. You pedal it. There's wires attached to these spools that turn these huge 20-meter diameter rotors. There's four of them. And then this thing like lifts into the sky. And there was a few teams that it was a $250,000 prize. No one had won it. Really came down to the wire with a few teams like really going for it at the end. And we ended up winning that as well and kind of propelled us into starting a company called AeroVelo based on making like ridiculous human-powered vehicles. And then after that, got into the land speed record stuff, which is these like high-speed aerodynamic bicycles. You sit inside a recumbent bike. You're inside a shell. There's no windscreen because that's extra drag. It's like a little tiny camera popping out. You look at a video screen and you're blasting down a highway in Nevada at 145 kilometers an hour. So that was the next project. We set the world record there several times in a row, got it up to 145 kilometers an hour. And that record's actually gone unbeaten since. They got really close this year, but it still stands. So that's like the human power. I'm just like, this stuff is so cool. What you can do on such a tiny amount of power, right? Like, a human is like the same as a motor I can fit in the palm of my hand. But if you figure out how, like, just super efficient engineering and pushing the limits on that, it's awesome what you can do. So yeah, that's the background.
That's incredible.
I guess we'll dive right into then the inception. So it's like, so me coming at this, I'm not really coming at it from a pump foiler and how do we make pump foils more efficient. I'm coming at it from human powered aircraft, which are amazingly cool. Like, the feeling of flying on your own power in an aircraft is unreal, but it's just inaccessible. You have a team of 10 or 20 people. It takes 2 hours to assemble it. You can't fly if the wind is even breathing on you, and then you can fly for a few minutes, you know? I mean, there's record-breaking human-powered aircraft that have gone for hours, but that's not typical. Can I just
ask you one question? Because these things sound amazing, and I cannot even wrap my head around like starting something like that, especially when you think about having a family, when you have to think about, you know, some sort of income. How can you even like finance it or go at it? I mean, it's so much risk involved. Are you just a risk taker?
We got that question so much when we were doing this stuff. And it was just like, the business model was harder than the projects themselves. But we got sponsorship. Like, people would, especially once we had succeeded at a few of these, it was basically just like running like a Formula One team or something. Like, people would sponsor the project. It was all student teams. So we'd get just like a ninja student team together for the summer, like 10 people. We'd go like live in the same house up north of Toronto, go to work in this barn, just like all in with a small team. And it was like crazy what you could get done on a super tight timeline and with a really small budget. But yeah, maybe it's hard to answer the question from a risk taker, but yeah, the business model was hard. We weren't selling anything. And that's what, like, so the cool thing about the foil now is this is a human powered aircraft that you can fit in a backpack, right? Like, everything 100%. That I've dreamed about and done with human powered aircraft, water is 1,000 times more dense. And so the wing can be 1,000 times smaller. And all of a sudden now you have something that people can actually use. So it's been super cool. But yeah, where I came at it from is the human powered aircraft. And I just wanted something that could go on water, something like a mountain bike, something that would feel like you're flying over the water, that would be really efficient, you could go fast. And it wasn't obvious if it was going to be a bike or a pump foil or what. And pump foils were just starting 2018. And I saw it. And of course, this is like,
same,
this is the physics of my PhD, right? And I'm like, dude, no way. Like, I know this stuff. And there's no moving parts, right? So it's like all the complications of drivetrain and chains and all this stuff is gone. This is a project now I can take on with a tiny team, stuff I can build myself in my basement to start prototyping and get things going. So yeah, that was kind of when it crystallized, when I saw the first people pumping. They hadn't even gone for a minute. And I'm just running the numbers on the physics. And it's like, this is possible. Like, we can scale this up, we can increase the span, and it's possible to go for hours. And that's when I was kind of sold on, like, yes, this is the next thing I'm doing and going all in.
And that was 2018.
That was, so 2018 is like, it crystallized. I went back to work in California after our year off. COVID hit in 2020, and we wanted to move back to Canada because no one could travel, no one could visit, we couldn't see family. We moved back in 2020, and I was still kind of working part-time for the company in California. And then in 2020, 2021 is when I went all in.
Amazing. But then when you saw that pump foil, remember what it was, who it was? Were you immediately like, yeah, that needs to work? Because when I saw it for the first time, and obviously I'm not in that area, I just saw it from a water sports perspective. Yeah, that looks good. If I were to see it now, I would think it's AI, because it still looks... Yeah. So incredible.
It is.
I mean, but for you, it was obvious that should work.
It was. So it's easy to run the numbers. Like, the formulas aren't that complicated. And it's easy to say it should be physically possible, which is much better than running the numbers and being like, it's not physically possible. So it's like, it should be physically possible. That doesn't mean that it's easy. And there's going to be a whole variety of challenges. And one of them was just like, is it possible to control a span that big using only weight shift, right? Like, when aircraft first were starting, like some of the early gliders, they were just weight shift controlled. And as the spans got bigger, you just can't control it with weight shift, and you need movable control surfaces. So that was a big question. Like, we're just using weight to shift this. There's no moving parts. Definitely, it was huge unknown if it was physically possible for the whole concept to really work.
Okay. Did you go underwater with one of these first foils to see how it felt?
So I thank Devin Mance, Wake Thief, for really getting the practical side to mesh with the theory that I was working on. Even when we were in California, before we moved back, I was trying to get up. Like, I had a winch thing. I had seen his winch thing online. I had a big, like, wing foil size board and a foil that just wasn't going to work, and I'm winching myself up, and it wasn't really until like the 1150 videos and the dock launcher where it was like, okay, now I can like actually do the thing that I'm trying to calculate. So that was like 2020-2021 that I really like hit the ground with something that kind of matched, like, brought the theory to something that was actually working in practice and started getting it to go together.
How was your experience on the water on foil? Because, you know, you look like a very sporty guy, and obviously you know the numbers and the theory, but how was it to bring that on the water, on the dock?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have, like, my background, I don't know how many people in pump foiling are like this. It's like, I've got an endurance athlete background, not a strong endurance athlete, but I've done a lot of sports, done some endurance sports, but also just like, I grew up doing all like juggling, unicycle, slackline, like just, I would just spend hours on my own learning ridiculous skills. That was just like what I love to do. So coming to this, I didn't feel that helps. Like, oh man, this is like insurmountable. This is going to be the big challenge. It's just like, this is just how you learn something like unicycling. You just go every day and you fall on your face 1,000 times. And like, that's just how it works. So that was, I had a lot of experience in that, learning those sorts of like ridiculous skills.
Good.
So that came together reasonably. I mean, it's still like a month, and still every milestone is like, oh my gosh, I just pumped 5 times. Like, this is crazy. And, it progressed pretty rapidly. I was also just going all in, like with the 1150 and then with my first prototypes. I was just on the water all the time. And so I progressed pretty quick.
So you were out with the 1150, managed to go, I don't know, for how long? And you thought, all right, that's good. That's fun. But I want something better. And you just started to design it yourself. But designing is one thing, or like drawing it and then trying to build it must be a whole other thing. Were there people helping you already, or was that also you in your garage doing something like that?
Yeah, so a lot of the prototypes, someone I had worked with before in Toronto started helping with some of the prototypes where we were like machining molds. A lot of the prototypes now I just do myself. Like, it's just super quick. I can take an existing wing and chop it up and rebond it on different angles, make changes like that. I can, I've got a bunch of adjustable prototypes where I can make adjustments to it that aren't like, you know, the fixed size. So I've got sort of a whole wide variety of prototyping, from having someone do parts to me doing stuff myself, which is just super fast. Like, there's no hypothesis I can't test in 2 days if I can build it myself.
But then, as I said, you went with that 1150, but then you were not happy with that. Because if you would have just like, oh yeah, that's fun, that's the thing, that's, I'm flying now, that's good. You wanted to go longer. You saw it doesn't look efficient enough for you, or what was your
Yes, the 1150 was just me actually getting on the water and feeling what it's really like. But I didn't buy the 1150 hoping it would be sufficient and then think, oh, it's not sufficient, I need to go more. I had in mind like, we're going for hours, but I need to get the best of what's out there and learn about what already exists, like what can I learn from what already exists, combine that with what I think is possible. So it was really kind of just baselining like best in class that currently exists and trying to understand the details of it. And all the vision was for something that can go for hours, like just mountain biking, right? Like, the vision is just, I want to go out on a lake and I want to go. And the really cool thing, so the thing that I absolutely could not have predicted, all of our early brainstorming sessions, it was hard to, you know, even like the guys in California, I'm talking to everyone, and everyone just goes to like, okay, but then how do you start? How do you get up in deep water? Do you paddle up? Is there a motor? Is there a grappling hook? It's like all these ideas, right? And they all add complexity and weight. And a really good decision that I made early on was to just turn that off, to say, if we can't fly for hours, there's no point. Like, I don't care if I can start from deep water, if I can only go 1 minute at a time. Like, this isn't the thing. This isn't a sport. Yeah. And so put that away and say, let's just focus on endurance. We will figure out how to start later. And the coolest thing happened. I remember the day that the light bulb turned on, where I thought, whoa, maybe we don't need to start from deep water. Maybe we could just launch from the shore everywhere. But even when that light bulb turned on, I had no idea what was actually possible. But as the span on the prototype started getting bigger and bigger, as we're going more efficient, all of a sudden you could start from more and more stuff. All of a sudden the lights are turning on and it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And by the time we were ready to launch in 2023, that was like kind of the moment where it was like, this is no longer a bug. The fact that we can't start in deep water is not a bug. It's now a feature of the sport. And now it's part of like figuring, it's like skateboarding, right? It's like, what can I jump off of? Can I jump off this log? Can I jump off this beach? Can I just go explore? But even then, like, I had in mind that you would map out, you'd find the good launches, you could launch from the good launches, you might have to swim 100 meters. And now it's like, I don't swim more than 5 meters. Like, I get to the shore and I just find something and I launch from it. It's just unbelievable what the body can do. So that's the one thing, right? I could predict in the physics that it was possible to fly for hours. What I couldn't predict is what it would be possible to do with the human body if you figured out the right start technique, what you could actually launch off of. That I had no idea. And that is kind of the foundation behind free foiling and what it means to truly like leave the dock behind and be free.
That is what we're going to talk about, because I had to learn that it's a different kind of sport or discipline within the sport. I just want to like continue with the development, and I want to hear some stories, maybe some things that were like way too big, or stuff that was exciting as well, but not for your purpose, or stuff that eventually worked, or if you had maybe even two different things that both were fine and you had to decide. Can you give me some like stories in development?
Yeah, stories and development. It's just, it is unbelievable how many ideas don't work. And so your progress is simply proportional to the number of hypotheses you can test. How fast can you test a hypothesis? Do you have to go and order something and get it a month later, or can you build it yourself and test it tomorrow? I remember just a few interesting learnings of, like, early on, I had these aluminum fuselage. So my first setup, I'll tell you about my first setup. I built four wings with different, one mold, but then kind of cut them into different dihedral sweep, dihedral straight wing, aluminum masts, adjustable everything. So you can, like, move the tail location, move the mast location, basically just like fully adjustable geometry. And it's just like, man, the handling's so weird. I can't control this. I need to make a shorter tail. And so I go on the computer and I design a shorter tail and I get it machined and it comes a month later. And now it's like, well, now because I moved a few other variables at the same time, now the tail's too short. I'm just like, now the tail's too short and it's been a month. And that day at the beach, I just, like, brought a Sawzall, took the first prototype and just, like, chopped off the back of it. It is just like lesson number one, cut up your prototypes. Like, your prototype serves to test a single hypothesis and then move on. And so from that day on, it was just like, I'm not going to wait a month for a new thing. I'm literally just going to take my hacksaw out and get moving. So yeah, that was,
wow.
And that's so much more fun, right? Just like, let's think of something, let's test something, let's go quickly. Trying to think of, like, really big flops. I mean, there's just everything was just kind of, it was iterative. So many ideas that didn't work, but they're all just like little things. I don't know if I have any good examples of just like,
or maybe I can ask you something in between there. Cause when you, like, try something and then it doesn't work, how much is it doesn't work, or I just not good enough with that yet? I need to adjust my stance, my start, whatever.
Yeah.
Cause it's not the thing. It's maybe me.
It's absolutely. Yeah. And that's, I think, honestly, that's the hardest thing about development in this area, and why you gain so much from seeing what everyone else is doing and see what the athletes are doing. You know, my first test, the very first test I ran on anything. So I knew how to kite surf, and I was on a foil on kite surf. And so the first test was like, right, what everyone wants to do, get rid of the tail, right? This is like classic, like, I know a bit about aerospace, but not enough about aerospace. Get rid of the tail, right? This is what everyone wants to do. And so the first test was just like, take the tail off. And my conclusion on that test was like, it's possible to fly, but I don't like pumping. This just isn't going to make sense. You know, then Devin's videos come out showing them, he tests all the different tails. He concludes large, long tail length. And I kind of use that as a baseline. Like, I basically took kind of that what he had pieced together to make that Wake Thief package on the 1150, back calculate what are all the stability parameters that we would normally calculate in aerospace, doing like a stability analysis of an aircraft. And then that's kind of my baseline for like what I'm trying to achieve with my new design in certain ways. And the conclusion from that was like, okay, like we need this size tail to be able to pump with. And it's more efficient like that. And then now the last few years, you just see everyone going to like smaller and smaller and smaller tails and basically going to no tails, right? Nicholas Eitan is like, yeah, I just like pumping with basically no tail, and like Yvonne. Yeah. So that's a great example of just something where it's not clear what's possible. And it takes a long time to adapt. I've spent the last 2 months on the smallest tails I can possibly ride because I realized I was stuck in a local optimum of my preference. And so I've been able to shift my preference now with a month or two of training. So yeah, that part, the human element, is there's no magic formula, and we really have to learn from others, right? Because for me to be like, to test that hypothesis, like, hey, I'm going to spend every day of my life for the next 2 months trying to ride a small tail to test a hypothesis, that just took like me a lot of time, right? Whereas someone else does it, they say ride small tails, and I'm like, all right, I'll try this. Yeah. Yeah.
So you talked about Devin a couple of times already. Maybe we can also like include him in that part of you inventing or designing new things. How did you guys meet? How did that like co-ownership maybe, or that co-work thing start?
Yeah, so we met basically as I was diving in and just looking everywhere on the internet for who knew something and calling people up and talking to them. And so he was on the list. And then we just like hit it off. Like, he knew more than anyone I had talked to about, like, just actually pumping, like getting on foil and pumping, not necessarily the manufacturing and the aerodynamics and all that. And for him, I could finally answer questions that he had, that he had been asking everyone and couldn't understand. And so it was just such a good, like, we're just so excited to talk to each other every week about what we've been working on, what we've been thinking about. And, but yeah, basically over those years, every once in a while, we would meet up, I'd get his feedback on some prototypes, we'd brainstorm once in a while. And then when we went to launch, he basically took a role in the company as customer service, sales, and like basically just the person that would just interact with, the person that would interact with everyone on behalf, while I just like hide in my cave and like put my head down, right? That's, I work best through just like deep focus. And so that was a good, and Devin is just massively involved in the community. He knows everybody. He loves talking to everybody. And so that was a good team up there. But now, yeah, right now, like he owns his Wake Thief brand. I own the Beta Foils brand. He's a partner in that, but we each have our own vision for and different projects for what we're doing in the space. And then where we overlap, we collaborate.
All right. Very interesting. I want to continue with maybe that first Beta Foil that she did, because it looked different. It has like this triangular shape, I'd say. And when I talk to people now who design foils, they say, yeah, it is out, but I'm already working on the next thing. How difficult was it for you? And now, as I think I like got to know you a little bit, were you, when it got out, were you happy with it? Or were you like, no, let's hold on another 2 months. I have the next thing already ready. How is that for you when it went out? Were you happy with it? Or was like, it's yeah, like everything, we have to start somewhere.
Everything I've done, I'm driven to figure out what is the best we can possibly do. Like, yes, I was happy with it. It could do something. It unlocked for me a dream that I didn't know was even possible. And at the same time, I'm just like, we gotta change everything. But obviously not everything. But it's, yeah, lots of ideas every year. You think you've uncovered, you think you've figured it all out, and then there's still something left to uncover. So it's, yeah, it's kind of been a consistent trajectory since that launch. And every year the foil has gotten better by about like 3 beats per minute of heart rate. So every year I think I have 10 ideas that will all be 1 beat per minute. And like, most of them don't work, and one or two gems will pull through. So yeah, there's lots more to be done for sure.
I'm sure there are few of the listeners who have never seen a Beta Foil before. So we're going to show it here. And what stands out obviously is that huge span, but also the two masts. And when I had it in Silva Plana, there were a lot of people coming. They saw pump foils, they saw foils of different like disciplines. And they're like, whoa, what is this? And those two masts are kind of the signature of Beta Foils. How did you come up with that? When was the decision, all right, we have to do it? Because I suppose it has to do with stability.
It's, is that correct? So really, it has to do with getting an unbelievably large span. And coming from human-powered aircraft, it wasn't necessarily some huge light bulb moment. It was just like, that's what span-loaded aircraft do. Like the Daedalus human-powered aircraft has bracing wires. Our Ornithopter had bracing wires. A lot of human-powered watercraft that were on foils would use 2 spars. Basically, when you're just going for super high aspect ratio, you get a structurally more efficient system. And so that was the foundation. And then it was really about like, well, now how do we figure out the handling? Is the handling different than a single mast for some reason? Are there some quirks that we have to sort out? And the real hard part wasn't necessarily, you know what, there were so many weird things in the dual mast. The single mast path would have been phenomenally easier. You wouldn't have got to the same level of performance, but there was just so many things I didn't appreciate about what you'd have to do in a dual mast system to really get it to work. But yeah, the concept was almost from the beginning. And I've actually just recently done some really cool experiments, because what I've realized is like, it's almost like a different language, a dual mast versus single mast, and also like massive span versus reasonably massive span. A different language in terms of handling qualities, in terms of riding. So like, everyone now knows how to ride single mast foils. You put them on a dual mast foil and they're like, oh, something's different, something's weird, I'm not sure what's going on. It's a different language and it takes time to adapt. And that's one of the biggest things I kind of learned getting this out to other demo people like you, right? Like a lot of our customers, they get it. They ride nothing but that, or mostly ride that. And that adapting to that language just is a non-issue. I mean, it's riding a big span has its own difficulties, but fundamentally, it's not like, yeah, fundamentally, the problem is if you learn one language and then you try to speak the other language, you just don't know it yet. And it takes time. So I've been running some experiments recently to try to isolate, like, what exactly is the difference? It's really cool. Okay. So I've built a dual mast Indiana Condor, the Condor XL. And then I've got a single mast Beta. So I could try to get that, like, and then they're geometrically identical in terms of like where the mast is, how big the tail is, where the tail is. The handling is theoretically, like, I run the numbers on the handling. It's theoretically identical. What's the difference, right? What is the theory not capturing? So single mast, super cool. Okay. If you're standing, and this is really like, if you think about mast stiffness, this is how you should think about it. Okay. Put the foil on the grass with the foil down and stand on the board and then lean on your toes and lean on your heels and see how much the whole thing bends. Now, what you're simulating there is...
I'll be so scared to do that.
Yeah, you're going to get a lot of warranty cases for this, right? No, crank it over. It's definitely scary. Like, put a mat there or something. Right. I haven't fallen off yet.
Okay.
Okay, so you stand on that, you bend it, right? So if I'm standing there, and yeah, what you're simulating there is as if that wing, you're simulating like an infinitely large wing with a huge amount of roll damping and inertia that when you lean, like the foil doesn't even roll. All that happens is the mast bends. And so on, say, like an Indiana Charger 75 mast, I lean my, if I'm on center line on the board and I lean completely on my toes, I've shifted my CG, my center of gravity, about 7 or 8 centimeters to one side. And that's how much roll authority I have. I've shifted my weight 7 centimeters to the right. But what happens is the mast also bends an additional 2 centimeters to the right. So by leaning 7 centimeters, I actually got to shift my CG 9 centimeters. So in a weird way, the flexibility of a single mast can give you like 10 or 20% more roll authority, okay, by bending. Now it's bending and flexing, and like, I don't really like that feeling, but you can get used to it and you can actually use it to your advantage. So that's one of the things going on in this different language, is that you can use heel toe rolling a little bit more, like 10 to 20% more. Whereas on a dual mast, you find that you're kind of walking your back foot around more. If I go into a deep left turn, I'm going to shift my back foot so that it's more to the right, so I don't spiral back. So that's kind of one of the things. So if you're used to small foils, single mast, you're used to just like you plant your feet and you just lean heel toe. You don't move your foot around. But once you've learned to unlock your rear foot, it's, you know, then you kind of get that. And also there's a second effect that's happening, is that when you lean on your toes, let's say you have a really big span foil that has a lot of, I'm going to call it just roll resistance. The proper aero term is like roll damping. It's like if I'm rolling to the right, there's a resistance that wants to stop me from rolling. And that's the dominant factor in how quickly you can maneuver a foil. So I'm sorry, lost my train of thought here. Oh yeah. Okay. So you got a high span foil with a lot of roll resistance. You go onto your toes. It didn't roll right away because it's slow to roll, but the board bent right away. And so you got that feedback of knowing that like, the board is bending. You think it's the foil turning, but it's not. It's the mast bending, and the foil is slowly delayed.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
Okay. But it's giving you that proprioceptive feedback that like, I've started to turn in this direction. On dual mast, you don't have those tools. And so people are on dual mast and they're leaning a bit to the right, but they don't know they're leaning to the right because the mast didn't bend. And then because the huge span, once it starts turning to the right, if you haven't corrected in time, it's too late and you spiral dive. And that's really about the span. That's not about the dual mast. And so, yeah, so people getting used to the beta, they're like, I didn't even know I was turning, and then it was too late. And that's honestly, it's part of the learning curve. And once you get it, like for Devin and I, you know, when we're brainstorming the next iteration and people that ride the beta a lot, they're like, no, I don't want better handling. I just want more endurance. They're like, spiral dive is literally a non-issue stop talking about spiral dive. But then I give the foil to you and other people, and they're just like, spiral dive, man, I can't get used to it, right? So it's all I can say is that it's a different language. You've got dual mast. You don't get that extra 10% of roll authority from the mast bending. But what you do get is a system that's, I mean, for all intents and purposes, infinitely stiff in the roll direction. It's about 50 times stiffer than, you know, the best single mast on the market. And so what that does mean is that when you're in a turn...
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
No, go ahead. Okay.
So what it does mean is that in a turn, I'm going to do a left turn. I roll into the turn. I shift my back foot so it's in the right spot now. And I can pump hard through that turn. I can like get into that turn and just slam through the board, and every ounce of my energy is going straight into the foil. Whereas you do that on a single mast where you're pumping hard through a turn with an offset foot because you're trying to fight spiral dive, and it goes wham, wow, wobble, wobble. So yeah, so there's advantages and disadvantages to both. And the main advantage of dual mast is once you get to like ridiculously large spans and being able to control those and be able to really deliver efficient power without your power getting lost in flexibility. But I mean, for the other companies, I wouldn't like throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like, you know, they're figuring out how to make mast stiffer connection, longer spans, and they're going to be able to get to very, very large wings as well.
When I listen to that and the parts that I understand, I think, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm not following 100%, but I'm sure that's just my lack of knowledge of basic physics. When I look at your videos of you like going for a long time over that super flat lake, I always like, well, yes, of course he's super good, but also look at my lake. There are boat wakes here and there. Is there like the more wobbly mast helping in me just like staying on foil? Or is that also a technical issue?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think I haven't ridden enough in lakes with boats. I think I design more towards flatter lakes, and that's something I'm working towards as well. So that really became obvious on my single mast version of the beta, where it was like, no, it's not the stiffness. Like, it's not this dual mast stiffness that's the problem. Like handling a foil, like it's 2.1 meters, but there's also a lot of area near the tips. And that really increases that roll resistance. So it's a really slow foil to turn, but it makes it super stable and super efficient. So if you're on flat water, like you've just got this rock solid platform to deliver power. And then handling waves, like once you get used to the handling of it, waves aren't a huge problem. But yeah, the large span is the main culprit in making it more difficult to handle waves. Yeah. Yeah, that's mostly about the span. So your single mast, that extra flex, it only gives you like 10% more roll authority. It's not huge, and I can achieve the same roll authority by just shifting my back foot. So it's more that it's not that it's like, oh, single mast can get more control authority. It's really just that's what most people are used to, is getting their control authority just by leaning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Whereas shifting that foot around sense. And also you learn to anticipate the waves, right? It's like you see the wave, you know where it's coming from. What really sucks is when there's a bunch of waves from different directions, and then you're kind of like, I don't know what to do with this. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're always hopping on there around, on the but turn. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Finish up.
Yeah, go ahead. I remember when I was on Lake Toon and there was a little backwash swell, and I was just hopping all the time on the board, like trying to always like counteract whichever part was coming up. But that's also because, and you said that I need a lot of time to get used to that specific foil, because I've been used to changing foils, changing setups, but this is just so different to the ones that I've used that I really needed more time, and I still need more time. I don't get enough on the water as it is. I just wanted to ask another question according to the masts, because what I hear often is, well, you know, that mast is that much thinner and drag and whatnot. And I always think like, well, it's pump foiling. We're not super fast. Does it really make that much of a difference? I gave it to Hilti as well to try in the last week. And he said, you know, the mast, what I really love about that setup is the silence of the mast, because you don't hear no water splashing around the mast. How much like impact in drag does a double mast, but super slim double mast have, or is that like even itself out?
It kind of evens itself out. So yeah, our masts are like insanely thin. Like if you haven't seen it in person, right? It's like compared to what you think of as a mast, it's like 6 millimeters down at the bottom in width. The benefit of this system, a normal single mast, it has to carry bending loads and torsion loads. So you don't really take advantage of the carbon fiber. It's why aluminum masts are almost just as good as carbon masts, because your carbon, you have to put your carbon in the bending direction and in the torsion direction. And at that point, it's not that much better than aluminum. Whereas with the dual mast, they're only taking side bending loads. The torsion doesn't matter at all. Like you could put zero torsional layers. So all of it's in bending. You can make a super, super thin structure. So basically what you have at the bottom is just super, super thin masts. But in the end, one bigger mast, two thinner masts is kind of the wash. So the real advantage is not a decrease in drag, but the ability to make a bigger wing.
Okay. Makes a lot of sense. How much did you play with, as you said, that there's pretty much a lot of surface at the end of the wing, like making it slimmer to the end? How much did you test that and how did that go?
Yeah, the very interesting. So that's another thing where we have been preferring designs with more area on the wingtip. As we get used to this stable platform, it just kind of offers, like on a calm lake freefoiling, it's kind of what you want. And so I played with that. The 2024 prototype, the one I was going to start building, I built the prototype. It had much less area at the wingtips, and I rode it and I was just like, No, this is not what I want at all. And I like back to the drawing board, but now kind of appreciating the ability to navigate waves and wind. And yeah, effectively it's right now this foil, like it's unmatched in free foiling and endurance and straight line pumping in calm conditions, but it's worth investigating how to open up the operating range to a wider variety of conditions. I think I heard someone say about pump foiling that it's like, it's awesome because you can do it any day of the year. Like, right? It's like, this is the Swiss mentality, right? Like it's the middle of the winter. It doesn't matter. It's windy. It doesn't matter. And I found that I'm much more inclined to go in calm conditions, but that's also partially because of the design of the foil. It's also, we have one wing right now. The one wing is super massive. It's designed for free foiling. In the future, we'll have different sizes. So it's like, oh, it's a windy, wavy day. I'm going to take the smaller one today. You know, I won't be able to go as far, but I'll be able to enjoy
it. Makes a lot of sense.
The surf a bit more.
Let's talk about that free foiling, because that was also something that I had to learn. When you asked me if I wanted to test that foil, I was like, it looks super, like, I'm not used to that at all. Yeah, sure, I want to try it. And I tried it. I was at Lake Toon. There was just like this pebble beach. I didn't want to like try the beach start with my other foils because I didn't want to scratch it. Like your foil is supposed, it's made for something like that. And I tried it and I could beach start there super easy. Now, like, it's just about like how to get going. Once you're up, it's going to be quite similar. And I thought that, all right, it's going to be fine. I pumped for a kilometer or something. I still felt fresh. So I thought like, all right, I got it now. I didn't have it yet. I still don't have it 100% yet. So I'm still working on that. But like this idea of free foiling, people need to learn that. And I saw on your website that you have this whole like story around it that you tell people, just don't buy it yet. Just look at this. That's what it's supposed to, that's what it's made for actually. And that's what you now said, that was your idea about like foiling forever on a lake, going like biking on a lake. How much difficult is it to teach that to people, to really have them understand your idea, your goal? Or another question, maybe, has it ever happened that people bought it and then didn't get that free foil idea?
Yeah. So I think I assume that when we launched the product and showed kind of launching from everywhere, exploring wilderness, that it would click. But it's, yeah, I found it a little bit harder than I thought to get people out of the mentality of starting at a dock and coming back from a dock and getting into the mentality of exploration. And so I'm not sure exactly what it is. I would love to hear feedback from the listeners. Is it that this is just like, this is what we do. We get on, you know, there's a lot of people doing long endurance pumping, but not necessarily with the vision of like, I'm just going to go explore. I'm going to launch. Like if I get stuck, I'll launch from somewhere. So yeah, the question, I'm very curious to hear is it that this is kind of what we're used to, or is it that it's hard to actually envision a foil where you could just launch from random things? I think part of the thing is that we've all learned to dock start by throwing the foil and jumping on it. And then you can rock start, but you can only rock start from like the perfect rock with that. Like when I first started free foiling, I had about 5 different starts that I would use. And one was like, you throw it and you launch on it. And like you miss a start, it hits a rock, you land on rocks, you're landing from the height of the foil, you know, spraining your ankle on submerged rocks, smashing your foil against the rocks. It was the knee start that all kind of brought it together. And now, even if there's shallow rocks, like I will basically push off, launch over those shallow rocks, and there's almost zero chance I'm hitting them because my weight isn't even on the foil until 5 feet from my launch point. And at that point, I'm on my knees and I'm gliding. By the time I actually go to start standing up, I'm 10 meters down course and I'm super far away from any obstacles. So yeah, I don't know if it's partially just not having the foils that truly can launch from anywhere, not having learned from the knee start, whatever it is, there's definitely some, or if it's just like, it sounds crazy for me to go off on my own and walk around rocks. And like, you do it once and you're like, this is stupid, right? Like you did it the first time. You're like, no, I'm stuck here. Like I'm 5 kilometers from home. I'm like, I can't get out of here. I'm cutting my feet up on rocks. It's like, yeah, there's a bunch of challenges. So it could just be like the culmination of all those things until you see your friend doing it. It's not obvious how you could get into it. It's a really good, yeah. Okay. You know what? So maybe I should just take 5 minutes and tell people how to get into it.
Yes. Let's do it.
Okay. All right. So first of all, in seeing this problem of people not really understanding how to work through the progression, I put a lot of time into a training manual. Check out the website. Honestly, it's like, it breaks it down from absolutely step number one to free foiling. Just follow that guide. Like it's all in there. Please give me feedback. I want to keep on making it better. But let me just give you the Coles notes. So first of all, high span foil area. I mean, it depends on your weight, but area, surface area, you know, 2000 square centimeters or greater, span like 1.7 meters or greater. Like you need something really big. You need to be able to knee start it. A really small foil, like, yeah, the knee start is what unlocks jumps. And it's right, like I had all these different ways of launching. And what I basically found is that when it came down to the hardest launches, I mean, the knee start came about of me trying to do what I call the lunging start, where I push the foil, I still hold onto it, I jump and I try to get to my feet, and I didn't make it to my feet, but I landed on my knee. And then I was gliding and then I stood up and I was like, whoa, okay, that worked. And then what I do now with a knee start is I'm standing up. I start leaning forward. I don't push until I'm on like a 45 degree angle. And on that 45 degree angle, I'm putting all of my force going forward. I can launch forward with such a high velocity that I can glide for 20 meters without standing up to pump. So the knee start. So now we also realize that the knee start is one of the easiest ways to teach people. So you might as well start with a knee start. Okay. So what I'm finding is people that start with our foil and start with the knee start. The best example is my brother-in-law, Nick. He's actually the one that came up with the word free foiling before he could even pump for more than a minute. This is his name. So he learned with the knee start. By the time he gets his 1 minute hat, he has launched 1,000 times with a knee start. And where he foils, he uses a variety of docks as he kind of like goes down, falls, uses someone else's docks. He's got a variety of heights and wobbliness. So I take him free foiling shortly after he's got his 1 minute hat. We go do a rock start. He nails it first try. We go jump off a log. He nails it first try. We go jump off like 3 or 4 things. He gets them all. I teach him a beach start. In less than 10 attempts, he's got it. Because our beach start is also, the beach start we teach is also a version of the knee start. So like the best person to start free foiling is someone that learned with a knee start, because they have just, right, the person that just got to a minute, they've just launched 1,000 times. And if they launch with a knee start, they're going to be able to do it off rocks. So that's my first advice. So big foil. Second thing is knee start. Learn it right from the beginning. If you haven't learned it, learn it now. It is the thing that unlocks the most challenging starts. Third thing is the shoes. I know that our Vibram Flyfinger shoes don't look super cool and we lose a lot of sales because they're just not the coolest shoes. But like you're wading around in the water, like you're walking through water, you smash your toe on a rock, you cut your feet open. Like, sure, it's okay. It's fine. Like we can all be tough about it. But the grip that a good pair of shoes provides you and the protection as you're like walking through those rocks, it's a thing that Devin actually started using them first. And it was the thing that for me just like made the switch from like, I'm doing the sport because I'm trying to invent the product and I want the sport to work, even though maybe it's a dumb idea. But then once the shoes came in, it was like, okay, no, this isn't a dumb idea. Other people will do this. It can be comfortable. It doesn't have to be like cutting your feet up all the time. So that's number three is the shoes. And number four, maybe I should have given you this advice before you tried on your like 30 kilometer freefoil adventure.
No. It's fine. No. It's all good. All good.
So start by just map out your local lake. Just find a few spots that are really good to start on and just go 100 meters and try to jump off something else. Go 100 meters and just get used to just jumping off random stuff. Endurance is next, but just kind of jumping off random things. And really the most important thing in looking for something good to jump off, at the beginning, I was trying to rate different rocks, like what's a, you know, like ski or mountain biking ratings, like a green circle, a blue square, black diamond. But really it comes down to just, is there rock hazard? Like, is there a rock hazard off this, or does it drop down pretty quick? If it drops down deep enough, you can try it 100 times. Eventually you'll get it. If there's rock hazards, you have to get it, or you have to clear these rock hazards to not damage your foil or get hurt. So that's just at the beginning, just look for, I mean, obviously like something the same height as your dock, you know, something where the rocks like goes straight down. So you don't have to reach out too far. All those details help. But the biggest detail is just find something where if you crash, you're not landing on rocks. And then you can try as many times as you want.
Yeah.
I think those are the four. That's it. That's how you should get into free foiling.
You know, I'm actually, I don't mind. When I went around or tried to go around Lake Brient, I always knew that this is going to be probably a failure, but I'm going to try it anyway because I like to go as far as possible and then just like walk back if necessary. It was still a good exercise, I think. And I like to go a little bit too far and then like just stop. And I could have gone further. I don't like that too much. But the shoe thing, it changed for me as well. I never use shoes. I just like to be barefoot, not because I want to be a tough guy, because it just feels better. I like to feel stuff. I like to feel a board. I like to feel the rock. I used to be a sailor and I sailed a lot, always bare feet, because I just feel where I stand. Yes, sometimes it got bloody, but it feels differently. And now I have these shoes, especially when I walk around like shallow waters, I don't see what's underneath. Then it's just, I can still feel I have these other shoes. No, not this five toe things that you have.
Which are the ones that you use? What are they called again?
Shit, I have to look it up.
You should link to them, because if people want to wear shoes UIP, but don't want to look as cool as wearing Flyfinger shoes, they can wear your shoes.
You know, they look like sneakers, but they have shoelaces that looks fun, but it's, yeah, they get open sometimes, which is not really a good thing. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I was there. It was okay. I failed, but still, it was a super good experience. And I think I got that adventure thing.
Yeah.
There's just one thing I want to come back to, because when he did the whole tour with a 1 meter, 88 centimeter span foil, regular pump foil. And I asked him, like, you want to like try the better foil as well? And he tried it. It's like, no, he can do the same thing as I can. And I didn't 100% agree, because that knee start that you said, he cannot do that. But then you said, well, I'm just going to walk a little further until I find a rock that's suitable for my start. And he can do like the drop start and also the static start. So I think that's fine as well. But it's just, yes, it's a different thing. I tried to compare the Condor and the Beta when I was at Sierra Plana. I tried to do the same exact route. And the start, it was the same thing. I couldn't start from the same spot that I could start with the Beta, but a little further, 30 meters further, there was a rock that was suitable with the Indiana, and that worked as well. So it's really, it depends on where you go. If there's a possibility that you just can do nothing but beach start, for example, I would never take anything else than the beta foil. Before we go into like free falling, and you have these free falling events, I just want to, and I heard that from another podcast in a little different context, but if you were to describe beta foils, if you were to compare it to a car brand, what car brand would that be?
NASA. We build rocket ships, not cars.
Awesome. I'm going to take that. I'm going to take that. So great answer. So you did these events. You just had one in North America. How many people actually have beta foils? Can you give us numbers? And how many people attended that free foil summit?
Yeah. So that summit was, we handpicked some people that we'd been working with on like helping them improve their efficiency, helping them with rock starts. But there was about six people that were like, kind of on the verge of free foiling, that had done a little bit of it, that we felt were really weren't ready. And so we invited just those six. All six were like, yes, this sounds awesome. I'm going to do it. And we just got a cottage in the Adirondacks. We just didn't want to do like a huge event, just wanted to keep it tight and really kind of go deep with these six people. And yeah, so we took them out free foiling. Day one, we go out in the water, we launch from the dock and we go out to a rock, and then we're kind of all hanging out. Basically, it was like a moving dock start party. We weren't trying to go big distance because not everyone had the endurance. And it's also not what like if you're at an event, you burn yourself out on a big endurance run. Really, it was about unlocking the starts and unlocking for people the concept of being able to go in everywhere. So the basically moving dock start party. And that, you know, the first day I remember like looking out and it's like, man, I'm responsible for these people. We got like kind of people scattered. It's like, oh, where's this guy? He's around the corner somewhere now. Oh, this guy's climbing on this rock. This guy's having trouble with this rock. And then by the second day, it was awesome. Like the second day, we all just like went out. I mean, maybe that's partially like just me relaxing and my, my mindset shift. But it's fair to say that after that weekend, those six people, like me, do not look at a shoreline the same again. Like you walk along a shoreline and you're like, yeah, I can launch off that. I could launch off that. Oh, that's a nice spot. I'll launch off that. Oh, that would be a bit hard, right? It's like you're just kind of eyeing it like a climber eyeing like rock climbing walls or bouldering problems. So yeah, that was an awesome test event, like really cool format. Absolutely want to do something in Europe. I'm trying to decide if we do another kind of small thing or if we try to open it up to a bigger event. But the real purpose of that is like, and that's why we went to a lake where like there's not boats, there's not docks, there's only just open rocks and wilderness. You can't do something other than free fall because you're still in the mindset of the thing you normally do. So that's the thing I want to do most with this event is take people and show them a new experience about how we can kind of navigate water and hope to like kind of turn that light bulb on for people.
That sounds amazing. When I look, I'm in my bubble. I have my Instagram, I have my social media, YouTube and whatnot. And beta foils is just like a very small part. And I guess it's also that free falling is a niche within the niche within the niche. But still, when you started to build that together with Devin, was there like a goal you wanted to achieve? Like we need to sell as many foils. If not, we're just going to have to like let it be and look for something else. Because you still, as you said, you also have a family that you have to pay your bills, basically. How's that part? Because, you know, for me, maybe it's just because I'm Swiss.
Yeah, no, it's true. Absolutely. What I didn't appreciate when launching is that we were a niche within a niche within a niche. Mm-hmm. Now we're kind of owning that. I'm like, no. Yeah, we are a niche within a niche within a niche. This is what we're trying to do. We're not trying to be everything. But I mean, also, you asked me the question earlier about my background. I guess you have to understand my background a little bit. I want to do the thing that inspires me the most, no matter what. And if the business model is the harder part of that, then so be it. But I see my role in this foiling world as being able to figure this out, right? There's a lot of smart cookies. Nice. Working on all the other disciplines that I don't need to go and compete there. But if I look at how kind of my life has been teed up for this moment, like this is what I'm most passionate about. It's what I'm most equipped to do. And yeah, that's the focus of beta, is to figure out free foiling, to unlock this, to build the most capable, inspiring free foil on the planet. We might have done it in the reverse order, right? If you like launch a new sport and you're like, we're only selling the NASA rocket ship, right? It's like maybe free foiling would really benefit from a super cheap foil to get people into it. That's absolutely a barrier. That's absolutely something I wanted to change. But you can't tackle everything right now. It's how do we actually make a foil can do what I believe is physically possible, pulling out all the stops, no compromises.
All right. Makes a lot of sense. With beta foils, I remember, and I still have to get used to the speed, to the foiling speed. And yes, it's super big, so you can pump slower than with other foils. And I was thinking, you said, no, I don't want to start from the water. But now, as I've seen, like people have these props that they can put on even their leg, or they hold it sometimes to swim back, and they get up to 7 kilometers an hour, I think. When I look at that, I think like it's not much faster that you have to go to get back on foil with the beta foil. Have you tried that at all? Or is that like, no, that's not our objective. We're not going to look into that.
No, it's on my list for sure. It's been on my list for a while. It's really just about priorities. Is there people getting up to 7 kilometers an hour just with a little handheld thing or something they put on their foil?
I think, well, they put it on the legs because they have like this strap they put on the leg, and it's like a little torpedo like that. I think it's called torpedo. I don't know.
The Weidu. That's definitely worth trying. I mean, if people are carrying that anyway, if you could get up back on foil with that, that would be, there's absolutely a product there where you just unlock deep water start with a motor that just like, I mean, right, with a motor, you can pump power into a motor for 10 seconds without overheating it, right? A motor can take much more power than it's rated for if you're just running it for a short period of time. So you can design a pretty lightweight system that could just blast you back up on foil for sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's more just that becomes a pretty big research project capital intensive. People are kind of already working on it. I suspect that I won't have to figure that out. That someone will, that there will be something, and I'll work with a company to strap it on. But there'll always be the diehards that aren't going to go with a motor and are going to just jump off the rocks. But yeah, no, you're totally right. Yeah, being able to unlock that would be nice.
We talked about free foiling, but I was also curious because I really like going down that route, but I also like the small, the fast stuff. And I love wake thieving at the moment. That's something I really enjoy doing. And I try to go with smaller foils so I can turn more, but then I don't manage to start. And sometimes I have a second setup ready, or a friend has one, and I just pick his if I fall to get still back on that wake. Is that something you do as well, or have done as well, but now don't have time? Because yes, free falling and development and whatnot takes a lot of time.
Yeah, I haven't done a lot of wake thieving. I was trying to surf this last season with the foil. It's not the best surfing foil, but I just want to see what's possible and kind of get into that more. But I think the like different wing sizes are definitely in the plan. I mean, just based on body weight. And then it's really about making sure, I don't want to start spreading into a bunch of adjacent disciplines, but if there's disciplines that really make sense, right? Like, okay, you can free foil. Well, what if we end up having like a 1 hour endurance race? Well, like this foil's too big for a 1 hour endurance, I mean, depending on the athlete, but if strong athletes are going to start coming into this sport, 1 hour endurance race is going to be on a pretty small foil. And so scaling down high aspect ratio foils, basically the dual mass system is going to benefit high aspect ratio foils. So if there's other, even just going down to different sizes, getting into shorter races and seeing where the system makes sense. Of course, I could do single mass stuff as well, spreading thin. I've always done well mainly through focus on like a single clear vision. And so that's kind of where I'm at.
Makes a lot of sense. Also, because you're a pretty small team. Who's in your team except for Devin and you?
I mean, I'm the full-time team. Yeah, there's a lot of people I collaborate with. You can't get like the quality of people that I want to collaborate with, I could not afford to hire, but they're excited to talk to me. And that's kind of how I work. That's, even with the human powered aircraft, right? We were excited young students working on some cool, inspiring thing. We literally just called up all the people that had built human-powered aircraft and went and visited them. And they're people that do the thing that they're the most passionate about in life. When they see someone else coming on and coming along and doing that same thing, they open their doors to them. And so, yeah, there's a lot of people that I brainstorm with and collaborate with that are just like, you know, kind of top notch in their respective fields that I'm really lucky to have.
That is super cool. All right, Todd, when I look at the time, we're way over an hour already. If people are still listening, thank you very much for liking, yeah, sharing the story. Is there anything else you want to, you know, talk about that we didn't address?
No, I think just, yeah, I mean, that the concept of a summit in Europe and other free foiling events, like, look out for that. It's something I'm really excited to do. I hope you'll obviously be there, Matt, I assume. You can say it publicly now so you can't back out of it.
Sure, let's say yes. I'm a yes man, you know, yeah.
Awesome. No, that's it. I mean, we covered so much, and you're right. And also, thanks for challenging me on, you know, I've given a prescription for how to get into free foiling. It's not necessarily the prescription, but it's a formula that does work if it's exciting for you and you want to get into it. Yeah, get in touch if you are, like, if this is just, you know, I've met some people that are just blown away by this thing. Like, I'm so excited. I want to go, like, map all of this. Like, you know, someone's like, I want to go live in a trailer for the summer and map out all the lakes in Switzerland. Give me a call. Let's figure something out. Like, I want to share this inspiration. I want to find other people that are excited to see what we can do with this, and work together with them.
All right. Very good. And if people are listening and they're in Switzerland, they think, I want to try it, just see how it feels. Then they can also, like, hit me up in the comments here or on Instagram at @MattOnFoil. That's always a possibility, and we can figure something out. That'd be super cool.
Nice. No, Matt, thank you so much.
Right.
I just want to thank you for all the stuff you've been doing as well. I started listening to your podcast quite a bit recently, and yeah, just kind of like, really, I feel like I know so many more people in the community, and you get to hear all these bits and pieces. It's a big multifaceted problem that isn't just solved with the theoretical understanding of aero that is my background, and seeing what everyone else is doing and kind of moving this along together. What you're doing is super important, and I, yeah, just want to thank you for that.
Thank you very much, man. Super cool. Well, then I'm sure we're going to chat soon, man.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome, Matt. Good to see you.
Super cool.
All right.
Have a good afternoon.
Thanks.
Cheers. Bye-bye.